Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis. I'm the host of the ABC's podcast Politics Now, where I'm joined by the sharpest political journalists at the ABC to bring you the big stories you need to know.
You'll hear analysis of the week that was in politics with me, Fran Kelly, joining PK for the party room.
And on Insiders on Background, join me, David Spears, as I zoom in on one big story and a key voice behind it, diving deeper into the policies, laws and people shaping our landscape.
All in the Politics Now feed. Search Politics Now on ABC Listen and hit follow so you never miss an episode.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap.
I mean, this is a historic moment. I mean, the president coming off of this plane, making his way to China, the first U.S. president.
Two of the world's most powerful leaders are about to hold a high-stakes meeting in Beijing. You're going to hear from someone who once advised the U.S. National Security Council and the CIA on China. Then, back home, we'll get to the bottom of the government's tax changes in the budget.
Mind you, you've just given me a big remit when you said we'll try to get to the bottom of this. I'll give you my best shot.
We've put your questions to a chartered accountant who trains accountants on tax policy. Her answers are coming up. And then later on.
You can see me now smiling maybe, but I just have an emotion to cry because this night it was a bombing of my native city.
Ukrainian mental health specialists are here in Australia, learning how to improve trauma support and rehab for war veterans. Their story is coming up. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Welcome to The Breakfast Wrap. We're going to cover a lot of ground today, from China to the budget to Ukraine. But consider this first story a bit of a primer for what is going to happen over the next couple of days, because later today, the US President Donald Trump will meet his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping in Beijing. It's been almost a decade since he last visited China. This time round, Taiwan, trade and Tehran are all expected to be high on the agenda. So what is at stake? And what do the two leaders actually want to walk away with? Our producer, Pip Cook, tracked down someone with a rather interesting resume. During President Joe Biden's term, Jonathan Zinn directed China affairs at the US National Security Council. He's also studied and given advice on China to the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. When Sally Sara spoke with him this morning, she asked him for his insights on what Beijing wants out of the next couple days.
What are President Xi Jinping's priorities going into this summit?
Well, I think the overall strategic priority for Xi Jinping that's animating his approach to this visit is really to maintain the fragile stability between the two sides. And what Beijing is primarily looking for is to buy time and space and relief from U.S. pressure, because they fully expect there to be another round of intense competition and even confrontation between the two sides. And what Xi really wants to do is have the room to continue fortifying China for the next round of the contest. And now, in terms of the particular issue, I think it's been very clear from the Chinese side. They have sent a loud and clear signal that Taiwan will be foremost in their conversations. It was notable the last two time that the two leaders met back in the fall that Taiwan did not necessarily come up. But I think especially since President Trump is going to be on President Xi's home turf, I expect him to lean into that issue pretty strongly. I think for the Trump administration's perspective, this is primarily a visit focused on, number one, maintaining the ceasefire in the trade war between the two sides, but it's also very much a trade and commercial visit as well. And I think you can see that from the constitution of the delegation, where there is a gaggle of CEOs from the United States that are accompanying President Trump on this trip.
What is the message on Taiwan that President Xi will be delivering to President Trump?
I think Xi will lean very hard into making clear China's position. And I think using the verbiage that they often use, argues that this is a quote-unquote red line in the relationship. There has been a lot of discussion about whether or not the Chinese side will push for some kind of rhetorical concession from President Trump that he would alter U.S. policy from not supporting Taiwan's independence to opposing it, which seems like a subtle distinction, but would have outsized, I think, ramifications, not just in Taiwan, but throughout the region. I think that's less likely that the Chinese will push for something like that. I think what they're more concerned about right now is trying to push off another large arms sale package, primarily because after the two leaders met back in the fall, the Trump administration did announce a $10 billion arms sale package to Taiwan, which the Chinese were very displeased about. And I think they saw as embarrassing to Xi Jinping. And I think they want to foreclose that possibility this time around.
What is the aim of President Trump with this visit, do you think?
I think that what he's looking for, again, I think it's primarily on the commercial side, right? I think he is looking for China to agree to make large purchases of various U.S. products, whether that's agricultural products like soybeans, or potentially, since the CEO of NVIDIA is going to be on this trip, some of our advanced semiconductors and technologies. And he's talked about opening access to the Chinese market for U.S. companies, which is all of which is quite striking. It feels like a throwback to an earlier era in the U.S.-China relationship. It feels like almost like something out of, you know, the Bill Clinton administration and the George W. Bush administration, where the focus is first and foremost on the commercial relationship with strategic and security issues lurking somewhere in the background.
How is President Trump's manner of speech and behavior, how is that received in China?
I think the Chinese have gotten used to it at this point. I mean, I think it's something they're uncomfortable with and they don't like it. Their own system tends to focus on, you know, very tightly scripting the choreography and the language ahead of an engagement like this. But I think because they've been dealing with President Trump for a decade now and thinking about how to deal with him for a decade at this point, I think they recognize how they can manage that. Part of what they've probably figured out at this point is that Trump's tendency to rely on intuition and instinct, especially in these high-stake engagements, in some ways can give the Chinese side an advantage, right? The Chinese prepare meticulously, almost excruciatingly, for these meetings, and it gives them an opportunity to game out the different scenarios for how this conversation between the two leaders play out, right? So I think at the start of dealing with President Trump, they would have found this off-putting, but now that they've gotten acclimatized to it, I think they have figured out how to play it to their own advantage.
Jonathan's in there. He directed China affairs at the US National Security Council. He's also a former China expert at the CIA. He's now a fellow at the Brookings Institution. Well, yesterday was a bit of a budget onslaught, but we did bring you the perspective of Bill Shorten about the government's tax changes. He said he was vindicated following his election defeat in 2019, where he tried to bring in a whole number of tax changes that sound awfully familiar after this federal budget. The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, has described these changes as the most significant in a quarter of a century. But not everyone is reading from the Treasurer's song sheet. Here's what the Greens Economic Justice spokesperson, Senator Nick McKim, told us this morning about what he would have rathered in the federal budget.
Well, we did want to see changes to the capital gains tax discount and negative gearing, and we've been campaigning actually for many, many decades to see real change in that area, because those benefits overwhelmingly flow to the wealthiest people. This was a moment in time when Labor could have showed genuine political ambition, genuine courage, and done something meaningful on economic inequality and to fix the housing crisis in Australia. And unfortunately, they spurned that opportunity.
So the Greens are going to be crucial in the Senate on this. So will you support the changes the government has proposed?
Well, we're working through the detail, and tax changes are complicated and there can be a lot of unintended consequences. If they are a step in the right direction, we'll certainly factor that into our considerations, and we've had and will continue to have discussions with the government about those things.
So would this be about the Greens wanting to strengthen or intensify what the government's proposing, or are these completely different measures that you'd like added in?
Well, it could be a mixture of both. We would like to see more ambition and more courage and more meaningful change. Well, there's a whole range of elements to this tax package. Unfortunately, they've grandparented in the previous arrangements on negative gearing, the capital gains tax changes for people who hold assets before the change comes into effect next year. Those that asset growth will still be taxed at the 50% discount level. There's a whole range of elements. There's also potential for other changes that we'll explore with government.
You can hear that full interview with Greens Senator Nick McKim on ABC Listen. So the accounting body, CPA Australia, has called these changes a tax grab. They say it places a heavier burden on ordinary Australians. It's prompted a whole number of questions around what the changes to capital gains tax, negative gearing and family trusts actually mean. So we're going to try and get you some answers. You've been sharing questions with our team. We've compiled them. And this morning, Sally put them to Joanne Hotston. She is a chartered accountant in Sydney who trains accountants in tax policy.
Joanne, you've been studying tax for decades and working in this area. How significant are these changes that were announced in the budget on Tuesday night?
Well, Sally, they're certainly very significant changes, and I can understand a lot of people will have concern around them because we're human beings. We're not great with change, but you did say I've been working in tax for a long time. You probably don't know how long, but I can remember 1985 when we didn't have a capital gains tax at all, and then one was introduced. And, of course, at that point, that was a huge tax change, and the sky was going to fall in. No one would invest in property, etc. So I think these changes, once most people understand them, and yes, some people will be worse off than they currently are, but I don't think the sky is going to fall in when it comes to property investment, etc.
How busy were the phones running hot yesterday for a lot of you and your colleagues?
My business partner did a couple of seminars yesterday, and she did have lots of questions from accountants. Mm. So their questions are probably delve a little more deeply perhaps into some of the detail. Mm. But yes, certainly that there will be a lot of work for accountants to do over the next 12 months and certainly over the next few weeks as well to start to get people ready for this. And there's a lot of information to be done. So that's up to the government to run a good information campaign and obviously to sell their case.
So we've got some questions that have come in. Richard and Jan are both asking a similar question. How will these changes affect superannuation fund investments?
Well, interesting enough, they actually don't affect super funds at all. So super funds sometimes are able to borrow to negatively gear property. We call those limited recourse borrowings. There have been no changes announced in that area. So whether it's a commercial property or residential property, gearing will still be allowed. The super funds, if you are in accumulation mode, which means your super fund is sitting there waiting for you to retire. Super funds pay tax at 15%, and capital gains have a 1/3 discount, and none of that is changing. When you move into pension mode, so once you retire and your fund starts paying you a pension, then the tax rate on all earnings and capital gains in a super fund that's paying pensions is actually zero. So there's no change to that as well. So short answer is super funds, you can just sit back. The big change to super funds was the surcharges that have just been legislated from 1 July this year and a budget announcement a couple of years ago for people with more than $3 million and $10 million in super. But for all the rest of us, with normal type super, no changes.
Chris asks, will CGT on shares also be taxed at a higher rate?
Yes, it will be. The capital gains, the current 50% discount, which will be removed from the 1st of July, is not just on property. It is on shares and any other CGT asset. So certainly share investors, apart from where your investment is in your super fund, will be subject to potentially a higher rate of capital gains tax. Now, in some ways, they'll actually be hit slightly harder than property because the current 50% discount applies if you've held the asset for more than 12 months. Most people tend to hold property for probably 5, 10 plus years. A lot of people hold their shares for 12 months, 2 years, whatever, and then they still, you know, once they get over the 12 months, they still get the 50% discount at the moment. So going forward, those people who have traditionally held their shares for a fairly short time, but more than 12 months, they will definitely be paying more capital gains tax than they are under the current system.
Mm. Well, Joanne, thank you so much for clarifying some of that. And we've had a text message from one of our listeners, Angela. Angela says, just a huge thank you to the accountant, Joanne, for explaining the investor tax changes more clearly than anyone else I've heard, including the Prime Minister, the Greens leader, the opposition and many mainstream media outlets. So you've got a bit of praise there, cutting through some of the detail.
Thank you to Angela.
And that is Joanne Hodgson there, a chartered accountant in Sydney, getting some much-deserved praise from our audience for a really insightful chat. Well, also this morning we heard from the federal government, the Housing Minister, Claire O'Neill. And Sally asked her about some of the concerns that we've heard about the government's tax reforms.
The Treasurer says the government's tax reforms will create a fairer housing market. But what's your message to young people amid a degree of cynicism, some of whom feel as if this is like pulling up the ladder for them?
Well, Australians have got a housing market stacked against them, and we want them to get ahead, and we especially want that younger generation to have fair access to home ownership. So this budget is about levelling the playing field for first home buyers and building more homes for the country. As for the concept of pulling up the ladder, well, that's just not what's happening here. We're not saying that no one should be a property investor. If you want to get ahead through investing in property, good on you. All we're saying is if you're going to get access to those generous tax concessions, we want you to help us with our national supply challenge by doing it on a new home.
What numbers are you working from in terms of how many Australians want to buy a first home and can't right now?
Look, I mean, I couldn't put a global figure on it for you, but what I can tell you is that we are seeing a drop in the home ownership rate for every age bracket of Australians, but it's particularly acute for that younger generation. We want to be a nation where if you work hard, you're frugal, you do the right thing, you get a fair shot, and this is what these reforms are about.
So with these numbers of 75,000 being able to become first homeowners, that's 7,500 a year. It's a small number. Do you accept that your own modelling also says that these tax policies in isolation will reduce supply?
Firstly, 75,000 people into home ownership is 75,000 households into home ownership. I completely disagree that that's a small number. This will
it's
reverse
7.5 a year.
This will reverse a decade of decline in the home ownership rate for our country.
Earlier, I spoke to Jacob Kane, who's the president of the Real Estate Institute of Australia. This is what he had to say.
What we really wanted to see out of the budget were more policies that supported the delivery of new homes into the Australian housing ecosystem. We needed policies that encouraged and incentivised investment in the space and removed planning delays and the regulatory burden that is really holding back delivery of more homes faster here in Australia.
He also went further and said red tape needs to go and that the Commonwealth and the states should get together to get rid of stamp duty. Your thoughts?
For all the complications in this debate, if we want to have affordable housing in our country, we need to build more homes more quickly.
So he's saying there's not enough incentives there to do that.
Well, let me speak to that because I think, there's some very important parts of the budget that actually address the direct concerns he's raised there. Firstly, a $2 billion fund that will help us build last mile infrastructure. So this is the boring but important part of housing that is about our water pipes, sewerage, roads, footpaths, all of those things. Now, investment in that and the lack of it is stopping us from building the homes we need. So that $2 billion in the budget will help us build 65,000 more homes for the country. Now, Jacob talked about reform at the state level. This is really urgent, and that's why as part of that $2 billion...
Should stamp duty go?
As part of that $2 billion, states will be required to make those reforms.
That is the Housing Minister, Claire O'Neill, there. And on that snippet that you heard from Jacob Kane from the Real Estate Institute of Australia, you can hear more of his interview also on ABC Listen. Well, once again, we are going to leave the federal budget and turn to a major story still playing out overseas, Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. It's now been raging for more than 4 years. And today we're going to look at the mental health toll on Ukrainians. Today, a group of 7 Ukrainian mental health professionals are visiting Canberra. It's part of a broader Australian visit where they're learning how to improve trauma support and rehab for war veterans. Dr. Antonia Pushko is the head of the General Psychiatric Department at a mental health centre in Western Ukraine's Ivano-Frankivsk. She's part of the delegation visiting Australia, and this morning she joined Sally Sara in the Parliament House studio.
What are you hoping to gather from this visit to Australia, speaking with experts in trauma and war in particular?
So I'm just one of the participants from the fellowship program, and we just had an expectation to gain more knowledge in a trauma-informed care for our patients, for both military and civilians who are still suffering from the war that is continuing.
What sort of cases are you seeing in your work, particularly with soldiers and or prisoners of war who've come back from captivity? This war has been grinding on. They've been at the front line for a lot of long time. What are you seeing?
Yeah, the thing that I have to mention is the war is not only 4 years. It started in 2014, and we have veterans from that period of time. We still have a big amount of military soldiers that are serving there, that are still serving in army, that need psychiatric help, special psychological support, and they are returning to serve in on a board line. Mm. One more thing, we also have a big traumatization of the civilians. Mm. We have just internally displaced personnel. It is about more than 4 million. You could just imagine from that occupied territories from to another districts of Ukraine. So this is a huge number.
Antonia, do you know how many psychiatrists there are in Ukraine to deal with all of this?
So if we are talking about the adult psychiatrists, this is an enough number. But if I will mention about the child psychiatry, we have just a huge problem. We have a gap in that thing. And now we are facing with the intra-generation trauma. So this is the thing that we need more child psychiatrists to cope with this problem. But if we are talking about the adult psychiatrists, there is also the thing that they are facing with the huge number of cases that we are now having.
One of the things that can often happen in war is what's known as moral injury, that people experience things, see things, are required to participate in things that go against their moral code, or some people wish they had taken a particular action and didn't. How much of that are you seeing when people feel a deep sense of moral responsibility for what's happening?
Yeah, it's just a huge problem. You can see me now smiling maybe, but I just have an emotion to cry, because this night it was a bombing of my native city, Ivano-Frankivsk, that you mentioned, because I'm from the western part of Ukraine. It is Ivano-Frankivsk, and just a bomb fall to the residential building. And this is a moral trauma of a civilians, because there were no military soldier there. And it was just in the day at about 12 o'clock. And this is a problem that rescue workers are facing with ambulance workers, because we have just a scheme from Russia that they are putting a bomb in one place. And after that, when the ambulance and rescue workers come, they put another one in that place.
Double.
So they just want to kill them, not to provide a special help for of such victims. So this is a real huge problem that is just continuing.
I can see in your eyes as we're talking, it's very emotional for you. How do you, as a psychiatrist and your colleagues, you're living in this environment as well. The soldiers are your relatives, your neighbours. How do you do all this?
So we have a just problem, big problem with a self-care, because we have just a pathological normalization of the feelings of anxiety, of fear, of even depressive symptoms. Because sometimes when a client comes to us and he is just saying, I have problems with sleep, we can say, I also, because I had an air alarm as you. But this is a pathological thing, because it's not normal to not to sleep at night because of the air alarm. Mm. This is the thing that is always, and we could not provide a safe place for our patients, just to provide a psychiatric and psychosocial support for them. So you see, the main thing for a psychotherapy is to provide the first thing a safe place.
You can't do
and
it.
There is no safe place in the whole territory of Ukraine. On the west, on the east, on the south, we are all together with this problem, because now we have a smaller Ukraine. Why? Because 19% of territory is occupied.
Dr. Antonia Pushko there, the head of the General Psychiatric Department at a mental health centre in Western Ukraine. And after listening to that interview, if there is anyone you know who needs support, current and ex-serving Australian Defence Force personnel and their families are able to seek free and confidential support from Open Arms on 1800 011 046. That's 1800 011 046. Well, thank you so much for listening to today's episode of The Breakfast Wrap. Those interviews presented by Sally Sara were produced by the Radio National Breakfast team, and The Wrap was today produced by Grace Stranger and Oscar Coleman. I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon. See you tomorrow.